This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Life becomes you. It goes with your hair. You certainly know the right thing to wear.
As a young pilot in Britain, he knows from the outset of World War II that the war will inevitably soon consume the world in a fight against fascism. Spitfire by B.J. Allen was printed in 1942 in London. It carries a publisher's note to the effect that the book had to pass the censors, whose work eliminated some of the identifying characteristics of the script. Ranks, names, places. It leaves us with this, a day describing the routines of a fighter squadron in winter, 1940.
It goes with your hair. You certainly know the right thing to wear.
On September the 27th, 1940, on patrol south of London, we see AK-AK fire ahead. A formation of 20 or 30 Messerschmitt 109 fighters alters course to attack our patrol wing. One of our squadron leaders takes his Spitfire into the thick of the enemy. We all follow. In moments, the squadron breaks up, finding targets where we may. I know two Messerschmitts are edging towards the strategic advantage of firing from beneath and slightly behind us. To counter their manoeuvres, I dive and half-roll my Spitfire, getting in a short burst at each of them as they pass through my sights. Coming downward, my Spitfire seems to skid sideways slightly, falling very fast. My left hand feels for the rudder bias control and winds the wheel back. Despite my attempts to pull out of the dive, I find I can't. The aircraft continues to skid. The mounting speed stiffens the controls to the point they don't help. The rudder pedal makes no discernible difference, and the altimeter looks like those whirring indicators you see in high-speed elevators. Seconds count. Can I escape the falling Spitfire by parachute? Not likely at this velocity. Must be well over 400 miles per hour. Having evaded the enemy attack at 25,000 feet, I'm still in the dive at 10,000 feet, in a Spitfire not responding to cockpit controls. Only moments remain till impact. Summoning desperate strength, I throw my weight on the joystick, bracing my back against the seat and both feet on the left rudder, determined to pull out of this dive. As my limbs reassert control of the aircraft, the nose rising to meet the horizon, I black out momentarily under the force of gravity. When I waken, it's to a strange vision. A parachute in the distance, but upside down, so it appears to be ascending instead of descending. My baffled mind makes no sense of why the sun lies below me. It's then my logic returns. While blacked out, I do a half loop. Now, by rolling out right way up, I'm in a position to see that mushroom of silk parachute as it ought to be, trying to recognize the pilot on the end of the shroud lines as they tangle in the top of a tree. The dogfighting over, I return to base. From other pilots, I deduce the parachutist is one who'd bailed out of his aircraft when it caught fire. As for mine, its trouble is traced to a bowed rudder, and the rudder bias being out of adjustment. This prevented me from being able to trim the aircraft straight in the dive. The ensuing skid caused the rudder to blank off one side of the elevators, diminishing their effect. It's become obvious now. The Luftwaffe's Blitz of Britain is over, at least for the time being. Rather than mass bombing raids, Messerschmitt 109s sometimes mount a bomb to heighten their impact. On November the 5th, 1940, over the old cathedral city of Canterbury in Kent, our squadron on patrol becomes separated in cloud. On glimpsing between clouds a formation of Messerschmitts, one of our pilots fires five-second bursts at a range of 150 yards from one, sees its cockpit cover fly off before the aircraft goes into a vertical dive, apparently crashing into the English Channel, 10 miles south of Dungeness, in a watery grave about halfway across to France. 10 days later, we're to protect a British shipping convoy off Thames Estuary. I set course over the banks of rolling mist covering the treetops. It's a glorious morning as sunlight plays with wisps of white vapour. As the sea mist clears, the Spitfires begin to run up and down at about 7,000 feet, the line of ships. Away to the south lies France. Plumes of smoke show enemy action, but it's not our brief to intervene there. Just as well, two white plumes are headed our way, fast diminishing the distance of about 10 miles between us. Climbing south, I aim to position the Spitfire where the dazzling sun will blind the approaching aircraft. They pass over the top of us at about 22,000 feet, heading up the Thames Estuary. Now turning in behind, we're between them and the sun. While still several miles behind, and at least 5,000 feet lower, I can just make out the leading aircraft as twin-engined, but can't yet recognize its type. AK-AK batteries begin to fire at the enemy aircraft. I watch white puffs of exploding shells bursting ever closer. Wondering how I'll ever catch up on the Germans, I try flying level rather than to climb. Now that's better. Over the outskirts of London, we're gaining on the enemy and begin gradually to gain altitude. Close on 30,000 feet, their aircraft begin to turn. They see us. They see us. They dive. We follow in line astern. All alert to effects of rarefied air at high altitude, I notice the airspeed indicator shows 400 miles per hour, yet allowing a margin for error, it might have been more like 500 miles per hour. The Spitfire's controls are solid now, with that force of air flowing over them. I need both hands and lots of force to move the joystick even a little. As we dive faster than the enemy at 10,000 feet, I set the sights on the fuselage of the enemy aircraft, sweating with the strain of holding mine steady, steady in the bumps of his slipstream. My head feels thick and almost deaf from the sudden descent to normal air pressure. Squinting through the sight, I press the firing button. Streams of tracer leap out of the wings. Three bursts, a pause between them to steady my aim. Then I pull back. An oily stream of smoke comes from the enemy aircraft. Another Spitfire's hail of bullets adds to the destruction of the other. Flames lick from under its engine cowling as it's trying to break away. Its pilot bails out as his aircraft emerges from cloud to plunge in a fountain of foam into the River Thames. A boat goes to his rescue. For the Germans, this brings an end to what transpires to be their photographic reconnaissance flight. On our flight back to base, the carpet of mist still covers the land.
Moonlight becomes you. I'm thrilled at the sight. And I could get so romantic tonight.
How strange that enemy activity to a fighter pilot is a tonic compared to long periods of enforced idleness.
You're all dressed up to go dreaming. Now don't tell me I'm wrong. What am I to go dreaming? Mind if I tag along? If I say I love you, I want you to know it's not just because there's moonlight, although moonlight. light becomes you so.
In civilian life, being at war without action appears in fact rather pointless after all the excitement of facing an enemy in the skies. For a fighter squadron, this involves a period of weather when it doesn't entail any great hardship on pilots. During the summer months, it is a case of being on duty 17 hours a day, but with the limited light of winter, the enemy activity involving the fighter pilots of Britain is less. However, once having tasted action, all other flying rather loses its meaning to the fighting pilot squadrons of the Royal Air Force. Reading all things relating to flight, how they could stand idle at a time of great threat. It's the only kind of flying that interested me. All else seems rather pointless. It seems extraordinary to me that anyone since the armistice could just give up on flying once they had started. But now I realize how they feel about it, and how we shall feel when the war is over and the sky will be empty of enemy aircraft. From habit, we shall still keep peering into the sun, looking for the telltale glint of a fighter above, knowing full well that no fighter will be there, and realizing that a sense of futility is bound to creep in after the war. Fighting is the supreme goal towards which all our previous flying has been directed. And now we shall have reached that goal, and the game will be over. We'll enjoy flying for its own sake, but it'll seem insipid. Having tasted wine, water will not satisfy us. When there's no enemy activity, there's training flying to be done. New pilots must be taught the applied flying which they can't learn anywhere else but in a squadron. The experienced pilots must keep their hands in. New tactics must be evolved. Night flying training carried on. All this, as far as a commanding officer is concerned, but still quite a lot of office work. After breakfast, if the Germans are quiet, the training flying commences and continues on and off all day. Good weather at dusk and some night flying probably rounds off the day's work. Except those down for flying, the remainder of the pilots are free until they come on duty again at dawn the next day. A pilot doesn't get very much chance for relaxation except in the winter evenings. But plenty of leave is usually forthcoming, and it allows him the necessary mental and physical rest. Dud weather means boredom, bad for morale. Give us something to do, particularly involving the enemy, then everyone's happy. Too much action is worse than boredom, of course, and when a pilot has had a bellyful away, he goes to a flying school as an instructor for the rest of his operational flying. Every day of a week seems the same in the air. Sunday's just another working day. At the beginning of the war, I always felt rather lost and never knew what the date was. But after a while, one gets used to it. It must be Sunday if the paper boy delivers the Sunday pictorial instead of the Daily Mirror. Leave brings temporary and welcome freedom. No longer does the ring of the telephone bell control your life, but the adjutant has got your address and you might receive a telegram. Return unit immediately, should circumstances demand it. As a matter of fact, during the Blitz, I found it very hard to get chaps to go on leave. They were all afraid of missing a chance of getting at the Germans' Luftwaffe. Now, however, leave is eagerly anticipated. The wing still carries out patrols in the hope of catching some Messerschmitts, and on November the 28th, 1940, a small formation is seen over Ramsgate. We have a crack at them. Three downed. No loss to the squadron. It brings our squadron's score up to 91 cases of downing aircraft of the enemy, and 30 probably so and for that our own casualties were under double figures. When I think back to when I joined the action in this war, the old faces are fast disappearing through postings to other units. Many have been awarded gongs, medals for bravery, for action over Dunkirk and during the Blitz of Britain. Some have such bad experience, being burned in a crash, for instance, that they never fully recover, though an individual we know resolutely refused to admit it and is furious when eventually he's posted away as an instructor to give him a rest from the cares and worries of a squadron and to give him a chance to get really on his feet again. New pilots keep arriving to fill the vacancies left, some to be posted again to new squadrons just formed after we had trained. And so it goes on. Sometimes a section of the squadron would be sent off to try to intercept a solitary German aircraft snooping about in the cover of the clouds on days of bad weather. But it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. And then one day we get a job after our own hearts again. A sweeps to be carried out over northern France by some bombers escorted by fighters and the wings to provide a covering patrol for the main formation. We fly down to the familiar aerodrome we had been stationed on during Dunkirk. We refuel and then cross the front. Memories come flooding back as I lead the squadron down and come into land on the familiar aerodrome. It looks just the same as it did 7 months before. A few filled-in bomb craters show up from the air, and the faces we meet there are new. The pilots gather in the watch office, talking and smoking while last-minute instructions are given. The aircraft refueled. We go out on the tarmac again to the spluttering and rumbling of engines being started up. I climb in. Run up the engine with more care than usual, then wave away the chocks and taxi away down the field, the other Spitfires following one by one behind me, to turn into the wind and wait whilst the leading Hurricanes are taking off. Raising one thumb, I wait for the answering signal from the other section leaders, and then we're away, thundering across the green turf, to rise slowly over the far hedge and climb up after the other squadrons circling the aerodrome and waiting for us. As we get into position, I call up the leading Hurricanes and the wing turns south and climbs away towards the French coast. We've instructions to patrol between Calais and Boulogne, and at 25,000 feet, we turn over Cap Grenet and fly down the coast, almost at once. The flak opens up at us from the Calais area. I turn to the flight sergeant and say good evening, and then out again to run to my aircraft. The fitter gets out of the cockpit as I approach and stands on the wing, bending down, waiting to help me into the cockpit as I do up my helmet. Catching my elbow as I pull myself up onto the wing, he helps me into the cockpit. As I settle myself on the parachute already in the seat, passes the harness straps over my shoulders and waits while I click them home, then closes the door of the cockpit. Okay, sir? Okay, thanks. And he jumps down. Checking everything in the cockpit, I wave my hand over my head and wait until the dim figures of the fitter and rigger wave an okay from each wingtip and open up the throttle. Another wave and the crew salute, and I taxi out towards the dim line of lights off the flare path. A green light comes speeding down the aerodrome to rise slowly over the far boundary, the starboard navigation light of Arthur's aircraft as he takes off. Glancing towards the light, showing the position of the floodlight, I signal on the identification lights for permission to take off, and as an answer flashes out, I adjust the elevator and rudder trimmers and turn down the cockpit lights. Peering over the side of the cockpit, the cold blast of air from the prop brings tears to my eyes. I have turned into position to take off, and settle back again behind the windscreen. As I open the throttle and ease the stick forward, the green light of the undercarriage indicator shines out dazzlingly in the dark cockpit as the throttle lever operated the automatic switch. 6 seconds later, the bumps of the undercarriage cease, and we're airborne. My right hand drops to the control lever, and after a moment, the green light on the instrument panel changes to red as the wheels thud up into the wings. Adjusting the airscrew pitch, throttling back, and closing the radiator and the cockpit hood, switching off the navigation light, I switch on the RT and call up the ground station. The controller answers me. He gives me the course to turn to. And we begin to climb. It's a wonderful night. The midnight blue of the sky, the dazzling silver orb, the moon. The ground show up startlingly clear. The roads and fields and hedges and rivers below, they stand out plainly visible in the moonlight. What a night for bombing. At 15,000 feet, I get instructions to circle and await further instructions. Peering down, I make out the outlines of houses and streets below. A few minutes later, the voice comes to me over the air.
There are several raiders in your vicinity now at your present height. Keep circling. They'll pass very close to you.
Okay. Minutes pass, and then below me to the right, I suddenly pick out the glint of something moving. As I look, I see the faint form of a twin-engined aircraft flying north. I call on the RT and receive acknowledgement. Diving down, I follow this aircraft, and over the city I get a perfect plan view. As I straighten up, the glint of the moon on the wings fade and it disappears. Frantically, I turn this way and that in an endeavor to pick up the aircraft again, but it's no good. Suddenly, brilliant flashes of flame spring from the ground, following a few seconds later by a cluster of flashes just below and in front of me. Our guns are having a crack at the radar. Although the explosions of the shells give a good indication of where the enemy aircraft is, I can't pick them up again from the sky, and after a while, I get fresh instructions. I've been flying for nearly an hour. Since there's a good headwind waiting for me on the way back, they decide it's time to go now. 20 minutes later, I'm over the aerodrome again at 1,000 feet, awaiting permission to come to land. However, there are still some Germans overhead. I'll have to wait until they've gone before I can get the floodlight switched on to guide me onto the ground. It's hardly necessary in view of the brightness of the moonlight, but my landing would give away the position of the aerodrome to the enemy overhead, and they might deliver us a present we'd rather not have. Bombs. A stick of bombs. I'm still circling when the controller's voice calls me, asking how much petrol I have. Pressing the button beside the gauge on the instrument panel, it shows me that I've still about 30 gallons left. I pass this information to the controller and receive a course to steer after one of those German aircraft. Climbing up, I set course and see above me, against the dark blue of the sky, the silver trail of a condensation plume. Good show. This is the answer to a night fighter's prayer. Up and up I go until I'm just below the trail, and then flattening out I tear along until abruptly I come to the end of it. Nothing's there. The German has either dived down or left that particular condensation area. I judge he's some miles ahead of me at the end of the plume. It looks a few minutes old by the way it's thickened out. I call up the controller. He confirms my suspicions. The German's too far ahead for me to catch him. Regretfully, I turn back and dive down. A few minutes later, I'm circling the aerodrome again. I flash for permission to land. Light comes back from the field. I lower the undercart and flaps and turn in to land. As I approach the downwind hedge, the floodlight comes on, the moon so bright that the light on the ground in front of me seems almost dim, although actually it's some thousands of candle power, and it's only as I feel the wheels bump on the ground as I flash into the beam that I realize again how bright it really is. Taxiing in, I switch off, climb out of the cockpit, and as I jump down to the ground, pushing my helmet off my ears, the fitter's voice echoes in my ear.
"Aircraft all right, sir?"
"Yes, thank you."
"Did you see anything, sir?"
"Yes, I saw one, but I lost him.
Bad luck, sir."
And the man jumps up on the wing and begins unscrewing the filler cap on the top tank, ready for refueling. From the roar of the engine and the slip screen, I now find myself reveling in the peaceful silence of the night. Once landed, the only sounds, the chugging of the tractor bringing the petrol tanker out to my aircraft, and the faint hum high overhead of a Spitfire climbing up into the moonlit heavens to try to find any dark invaders of the night. Lighting a cigarette, I make my way to where I'd parked my car, and throwing my helmet and gloves into the back seat, press the starter and motor slowly back to the mess hut. The electric light's been turned out by now, and in the light of two hurricane lamps, I make out the dim forms of figures sprawled out in the armchairs, snatching some sleep, awaiting the call to take off. A can of cocoa simmers on the coal stove in the middle of the room, and finding a cup, I dip it into the steaming liquid and settle myself in a chair to enjoy it. There's the quiet voice of another pilot in the chair next to me.
"Did you see anything?"
"No, no, it's all right. You can go to sleep again." I hear a soft chuckle, and the intelligence officer closes his eyes. All's peace again, save for the noise of a German droning slowly overhead and the sound of breathing from my comrades around me. Welcome to Tune In, same time next week, to hear the final excerpt from the book Spitfire by B.J. Allen. This program, Historic Souvenirs, is broadcast on Free FM 89.0, proudly supported by New Zealand On Air. Cheerio.
You're all dressed up to go dreaming. Now don't tell me I'm wrong.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.